Accession number 20063, Reel 2.
Mr. Channa, Reel 2.
The Manipuris were people of the plains and were from this valley, so they were different to the Nagas in build and physique. Well, we went on to the last village in the Manipuri Plain, which is about 20 miles from Imphal. Again, it's awfully slow moving with an army convoy. The bridges were just one-way bridges, and you only make about 5 miles every hour. And we got to Palel, and then we started climbing up there, up this, again, a mountain road to Shenam. Now, this road had not existed before, 6 weeks before. It had been bulldozed out of the side of the hills, the jungle hills, to connect over the top into Burma so that the retreating Burma army and the refugees could come out and escape from the Japanese advance. So this was now just a mud cut in the side of the road, and it was muddy and slippery, what with this monsoon rain. It was very difficult to get up. Well, finally, we got up to the top of the ridge there, and there we took up a defensive position. The Seaforth Highlanders were there at the main height. It was about 5,000 feet high, and in front of us was the mountains again and the jungle, and the road dropped down gradually for another 25 miles until it crossed into Burma, into the Kabul Valley, the bottom of the plain on the other side. And the Japanese, we knew, were somewhere down there, but we didn't know where, and they might come up after us. So our troops, we set up our guns on the top of the ridge, and the infantry started patrolling down into the Kabul Valley to see if they could find out where the Japanese were and what might happen. And they had a very tough time because on the top of the mountains, the mosquitoes were not so virulent. They were there, but they were not as virulent as when they were down in the valley. So that the Seaforths had to patrol down into the Kabul Valley, which was very malarial and very mosquito-ridden, and they very soon began to get malaria. And it generally takes, I think, about 8 days or so for the malaria to take a grip. By the time the soldiers came back from their patrols, they would collapse and with malaria. And it was said that at least 50% of them were lying on their backs with malaria within a few weeks. There was very little to combat malaria, because the only thing known then was quinine, which didn't stop it. It could only alleviate it once you got it. And the Japanese had captured all the places that quinine was manufactured from in Malaya, so there wasn't very much quinine around. So our job was to defend this ridge as best we could, and this is how we were doing it. So after a time, it was raining all the time, and it's one of the places in the world where I found the rain was horizontal, because the wind, there was a breeze all the time coming over the top of this ridge, and it drove the rain into our faces in a horizontal manner, and it was very wet. We tried to keep our ammunition dry, and fortunately the Japanese didn't attack us. And after 5 weeks up there, our troop was relieved by another troop, and we went back to Imphal. I don't know what happened about the infantry, whether they got relieved or not. Well, then we proceeded. Then the monsoon finished, and we proceeded to do a lot of training in the Imphal Valley. From one place to the other, we went training, we went digging, we had to dig defenses and practice all that sort of thing. And this went on for quite a time. Meanwhile, the infantry was still spread out in a thin line to try and find out what the Japanese were doing. There were skirmishes with the Japanese, but no very big battles. And this went on from 1942 into 1943, and then the infantry who had to patrol down into the Khabur Valley began to find that they, at least it seemed that they needed some help, so the gunners were called upon to do infantry patrols, and I was trained up on going on a jungle training course, a survival in the jungle and so on, about 5 days it was, and then I took a patrol of infantry, 6 Maratha infantry and about 10 of my gunners down to the Chinwin River, which was 50 miles in front of our forward defences, and I was told to go to this river and sit there for 3 days and see if there were any Japanese around and then come back. And this was a very interesting hike. It took 3 days to go there, 3 days there, 3 days back. So we had to carry 10 days worth of food. I had an interpreter with me who would talk to the villagers along the way. And it was very hot. It was dry that time. Very sweaty work. But wonderful views of the mountains, just covered with trees as far as the eye could see. And every now and then, paddy fields, villages. We stopped in villages and locals gave us a shack, a house to sleep in for the night. Then we pushed on. We found out from the villagers there were no Japanese around. And we got to the river and we sat on the river for 3 days. Didn't see any Japanese. The locals on our side of the river told us that there hadn't been any Japanese around. And there I did a foolish thing, because the Chinwin River for over a year had been our sort of, well, out there with the enemy, you see, and so I thought, I was told by my colonel not to cross the Chinwin River, but I thought, well, I'd like to see what's on the other side. So I got my interpreter to talk to some locals, villagers, and hired a couple of canoes. These were canoes made out of hollowed tree trunks, just room enough for one man to sit in them, about 3 men could sit in them, long things. And I took 3 men, I think myself and 2 men in one, and the man paddling it, and then another canoe with 2 men in it with their rifles and whatnot. And we got into this, and this, the bank of the river was very steep. And this river, of course, in the monsoon would rise 10, 20 feet anyway, but it was now medium height, but it was very steep down to the bank. Then it was about 200 yards across. On the far side was jungle, and we could see a bit of a village. And, of course, it was a stupid thing to do. If there had been any Japanese over there, we would have been for it. Although, from our side of the river, the locals said they hadn't seen any Japanese, and they didn't think there were any on the other side. Well, when I got into that canoe and we started paddling across, the whole thing was so unstable. If you shifted at all, it rocked, and it would, you know, you had to just keep absolutely still. And the river was running very fast. From the banks, it looked a very calm, sweet river. But once you were in it, it was a bit terrifying. Well, we got to the other side, and we talked to some villagers over there. They said some Japanese had passed through about 10 days before. And then we got in our canoes and came back. But it was a stupid thing to do, I know, and I disobeyed an order. I'd been lucky. I was arrogant and foolish. Well, the way we didn't see any Japanese, and we then marched back again. And we did some more this kind of training for quite a long time, and then the Japanese had started to attack. That was 1944, March 1944. We went up there in May 42. Now it was 2 years later the Japanese attacked Imphal, having attacked in the Arakan, and both armies were preparing to advance on each other. They had to get all their supplies up to the north of India, and we had to get supplies up into Imphal. They called us the Forgotten Army, as people said, and our supplies were very thin. We could feel that behind us. I mean, the war in the Middle East was not going too well, and we were pushed everywhere, so we were the last, and our supplies weren't too good. It was quite a long time before we got some decent food, actually, up in Imphal. When we were on the Shenam Ridge, we were eating nothing but biscuits and tinned meat, and we did have a problem of health because a lot of men got jungle sores, which were sores on their legs about, and body about the size of a 50p piece. The skin just broke and started separating, and they then were not capable of working properly with the, because if these sores were rubbed by their clothing and so on, they could just spread much faster. So they were, the doctor would say that they were sick and they would lie on their beds. And I think in our troop, we had 50% of our men had these jungle sores. Fortunately, I didn't get any. But as soon as we got some bread and some vegetables, which the army then started organizing from the Imphal plain, then that immediately took care of these jungle sores. It was just a question of malnutrition. So then the Japanese attack started against Imphal in March 1944. Our division had been ordered to advance from Shenam. The whole 23rd Division went from Shenam down into the Kabul Valley. And we thought, oh good, now we're going to go and sock these Japs for once and attack them. We went down into the valley and again we dug positions. We were all, us gunners, we were always digging positions here, digging positions there, and then leaving them. And my men were pretty fed up with this sort of thing. And so was I. But after we'd been down in the Kabul Valley for about 2 weeks, we were suddenly ordered right back to Palau, because the Japanese had started attacking, and Slim, the army commander, was withdrawing back to Imphal to shorten lines of communication. And our regiment went right back into the center of the valley. And the Japanese proceeded to do a right hook through the mountains and captured Kohima, as history knows. And they tried to drive into Kohima. They did drive into it, but they didn't capture it entirely. But they did get onto the road, and they, I think it was for about 60 days, they cut that road back into to Dimapur, which was our lifeline for supplies. However, by this time, the main airfield had been built near Imphal, and that was up and running, so that we were supplied then by air. I believe Churchill phoned Roosevelt to ask him for some airplanes from the American effort over the hump from Calcutta into China, divert some DC-3s, and I think DC-3s came from Italy as well, to provide an airlift into the Imphal. And I think there were 90 planes a day coming in during the Battle of Imphal, which lasted for about 80 days. The Japanese got round and cut that road at Kohima. And our regiment was, they were also advancing from the south up the Tidim Road. They were also advancing up against Shenam, and they were stopped at Shenam by one of the divisions of the infantry there. And at the same time, they were advancing in the north. They had advanced as far as Kohima, and they were trying to drive down from the north to capture Imphal. They hoped to take Imphal with all the supplies that we had built up over the last 2 years, which would give them a boost for their further advancement. So our job was to now defend Imphal, prevent it from being captured. And the divisional commander, the corps commander, General Schoons, put the 158 Field Regiment in reserve. And when he thought the Japanese were coming from the south, he sent us south. And then he thought they were coming from the north, he sent us north. So we spent our time digging positions in one place and another, and then being shoved off elsewhere. And finally we went off to the north, along the Ukrul Road, where a Japanese division had passed and gone towards Kohima. And that's where we, for the first time, started firing our guns. I was a lieutenant, and I was now a GPO, gun position officer. I'd got a little promotion in job, and I wanted to be an officer after the war, and I'd got my name down now for a regular commission. And I would, in due course, be when the war was over, perhaps be tested for that. Anyway, my name was down, and this was my job and my career, really. But our guns were in a position called the Wenjing Box, right in the middle of the Imphal plain. They were nicely dug in, everything was ready, but the Japanese were not attacking us yet. And my men were... I was grumbling one night in the officer's mess, which was one of these thatch huts, and we could hear the Gurkhas firing on the hills about 5 miles away. The Japanese by this time had really surrounded the Imphal plain, and they were sitting on the hills around us. They couldn't come down out of the hills because we had some tanks on the ground there. So there was firing going on within a few miles of our position, and I said to the... I wouldn't have said it in the position... had the Major been there, Major Smith, with the battery captain, was there, and I said, well, if I'd been in the Gurkhas like my father, at least I'd have been doing some shooting now. Firing and in action rather than sitting on our bottoms, sitting on my bottom in this box, which was a defensive position. And I think he must have reported me to the Major, because a couple of days later, the Major phoned me up and said he would come and inspect my guns in an hour. And I told my sergeants to polish everything up and have them ready. Major arrived and said he didn't want me to go round with him, which I normally would have done with my notebook. He'd go round on his own. So he went to each gun position, gun pit, and then he called me aside and he said, look, there's rust on number 4 gun. Why? So I couldn't give him an answer. The sergeant had taken his oily rag around that place, point, and I was in trouble. So then he said he was dissatisfied with my state of morale. I had been keen, he said once, but now he was dissatisfied with me. So I knew immediately that this remark had been possibly reported to him. So he gave me a big dressing down and left. We then moved to another position on the north of Imphal, and there we started digging in again, and the road ran past us. It was about 8 miles from Imphal, and then about 5 miles away on our left was the airfield, and then about a mile from us was a tremendous ridge which ran like a finger down into the middle of the Imphal plain, landing up about 4 miles from the airfield. And the Japanese had infiltrated along this ridge, and they were looking down on the airfield about only 5 miles away. But they couldn't come off this ridge, which was about 1,500 feet up from the valley floor, without us getting at them pretty quickly with our tanks and mobility. But they were dug in up there. We could see their slip trenches and their dug-in positions on this ridge. And I wondered, why don't they let us give a shoot up there? And, you know, open the fire for the first time, but we weren't given any order. Finally, some tanks came rolling up the road, and they did a shoot against these Japanese positions, and then they trundled off back from where they came from. Meanwhile, we still kept digging, and then when our gun pits were about half dug, it used to take about 6 days to dig a gun pit from the time you arrived, and our men were about halfway in dug. And I dug my command post, and we had a tarpaulin over it in which I had my maps and all the rest of it, the gear for the marking up the targets. And in the middle of the night, my telephone operator said to me that he heard by induction. That means that he could hear other telephones as well. And he heard the adjutant of the regiment ordering certain troops to move in the morning at 5 a.m. And he said our troop was one of them, F troop. So it was about 1 o'clock in the morning. And I went out and told my men to stop digging. And they didn't like digging, and it meant that I had to keep on going after them and chivying them and appearing. Otherwise, if I didn't appear, they would just lean on their shovels some of the time. They dug as much as they could. We didn't have any enemy artillery, but if there'd been any enemy artillery firing at us, we'd have all dug like fury. Well, I told them to get some kip, and not long after that, Captain Carr, the battery captain, who heard my remark, appeared, and he said, why aren't your men digging? So I said, well, I've heard by induction that we're going to be moving in the morning, so I thought it would be good to go and get some sleep. So he said, nobody's told you to stop digging. Get your men out digging again. There's a certain amount of fear. We hadn't actually been in action, so people were afraid. The Japanese sometimes infiltrated men and attacked gun positions, so we had to be dug in. But he was keeping strictly to the book. anyway, I went out, told my men to get out of their bed and start digging again. Well, surely enough, about an hour later, at 3 o'clock in the morning, the order came through that we should move at 5. So I was back out there telling the chaps to sleep again. So we then moved and went to another position further forward and started firing for the first time. And nobody complained that the shells were landing in the wrong place. Everything seemed to be going pretty good. The colonel came by, and he didn't complain that my men hadn't dug deep enough. I was going ready to say to him, we've been doing a lot of shooting, so we haven't had time to dig. Then suddenly in the evening, every night we used to have to lay on the SOS task, which was a target right in front of the infantry, maybe 150 yards in front of them. In case they got attacked in the night, they could phone down, or our own OP officer could phone down or radio down and say, SOS, fire. And we would have the guns loaded and just pull the triggers and put some shells down in front of our infantry to protect them. And I'd ordered men to lay the guns on the SOS task. You do that just before it gets dark. And ready for the night. When suddenly the major appeared. Normally he would be up in the front line with the infantry, and he suddenly appeared. I wondered, now, what is he going to land me for? And he said, I've been round your guns. How did he manage to go round them without me spotting him? I was probably in my dugout. Anyway, in my command post. He said, look, one of your guns, number 3 gun, the elevation bubble is not level. Why? That meant that the layer had not actually brought the gun down fully to the right elevation. It was a gun that was not aimed on target right. This is the greatest thing you could do wrong in the gunners. So the major said, I'm not satisfied with you. I've lost confidence in you. You give your job over to Lieutenant Goulding, who's my junior, and you go and be the assistant command post officer at the battery command post. This was the junior officer's job, the assistant command post officer, and I was one of the senior lieutenants, so I was getting demotion on the battlefield, and it was terrible. I was humiliated. I just picked up my pack, and without a word, I marched off. Found myself doing assistant command post officer's job. Well, it took me about 3 weeks to get over that. I actually finally put up a prayer, actually. I prayed. I said, oh, God, I made a mess of this. You've got to give me a different start. So I then stopped dodging the major whenever I saw him. But I had this junior job now. But I was now a free, spare man, really, and he sent me up to the OPs, to man the OPs with the infantry on different jobs. And I was good at hitting targets quickly. I had a knack for putting the shells in the right place pretty fast. So I did one or two of these jobs and went with the Gurkhas on a ploy whereby this long ridge that reached down like a finger towards the airfield was going to be attacked at its tip by tanks going up and all that, and they were expecting the Japanese to retreat along this ridge. And I was sent with some Gurkhas to put a stop on the ridge about 6 miles behind the point where the Japanese were at the tip of the finger, and it was expected that they would retreat along this ridge and run into us. So I was told to go with these Gurkhas, a company of Gurkhas, and we marched along the valley floor in full. Of course, it was daylight. Any Japs on the ridge could see us marching along. And when it got dark, we then started climbing up. We had to climb 1,500 feet up to the ridge. It was pretty tough going. One was pulling at the bushes on right and left with one's hands to yank oneself up this ridge with all the weight of gear we had. And then we reached the top. I was a great fiddler, fiddled with things, and I still do fiddle with things. And when we stopped halfway up the ridge for a rest, the jungle was a little clearer. There was a huge tree which I leant up against, and I pulled out my compass and started fiddling with it. And next morning, when we reached the top of the ridge, I suddenly realized that I hadn't got my compass. gosh, this was something you needed your compass at any time. So the infantryman was actually putting his men out on this knife head ridge. And I said to him, I've got to go down and get my compass. So I ran down that ridge through the jungle, and it took me 10 minutes to get back to that tree. And by golly, I found it. But it took me 40 minutes to climb back up. And by the time I got back up, I could hear firing on the left, because there was a village to the left and a knob, sort of raised. We called it a knob. And the Gurkha commander told me he was going to send a patrol over to the left to see if anybody was down that way. Well, I could hear the infantry firing from this knob. And I wasn't there. I wasn't in my right place. So I worked like mad, and I got back to the infantry bloke. And he reported that his patrol had come back. They'd found a number of Japanese in a tent there and shot them up. And so I proceeded to put some shells down onto this position, this knob. And the major had told me that knob was a particular mark on the map. He said, we'll call that target tit. So if you want any fire, you can immediately call target tit without working out your angles of sight and so on, and we'll put a shell down for you and you can adjust. So I called up for target tit, one round fire, and nothing happened. I should have had an answer within 30 seconds. A shot should have come up. Nothing happened. I told the radio operator to repeat it, and he repeated it. And he repeated it. It took about 3 minutes for a shot to land. And then I put down some fire on the... I adjusted it and put fire down onto this particular knob. And at that point, the infantry commander then told me the Japanese were coming along the ridge and beginning to attack. And after a few minutes, he said, this is hopeless, I can't hold this. But you couldn't dig in, it was just hard, hard soil. And he said, I've got to get off the ridge. So he then ordered his men off down into the valley, and we went back, right down to the bottom again. He lost control of his blokes, and they did trickle down. He finally had to collect them right at the bottom. So that was the end of my effort, to my first action.
Which battalion of Gurkhas was that?
I forget which one was, because there were three battalions. And I then, my radio operator also fell coming off the top of the ridge, and immediately my radio was out of action. I had a heliograph alternative method but difficult to find an empty space to flash the sun in the jungle, so we didn't have to do anything anyway. We didn't have to fire anymore, but my radio was bust, and it was a good lesson for the future, and it paid off. Anyway, I was then retreated back to the battery, and when I went to the gunner of that particular troop whom I'd asked for fire from, I asked him, what happened? Why didn't I get some fire on Tet immediately? And he said, well, none of us knew what it was. I had to call battery command post and ask them what Tet was. Nobody there knew about it. And so they finally had to find the major wherever he was. He had not told anybody. Extraordinary. So that was the end of that. Then, after a time, I was then sent off on a ploy with some infantry, about 6 or 7 miles overnight marching and what have you, to try and chase these Japanese who'd gone in the direction of Kohima, where they'd passed by, and we didn't get them. But we went with infantry, and that was a time when we didn't know whether we were going to be attacked any minute. So I remember keeping my boots on for 8 days. It was the longest time I kept my boots on, for 8 days and nights without taking them off, except for about 3 minutes every day to one...